Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to New Books in Sports, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I am Dr. Jorge Ver of Texas Tech University, the host of the channel. Today, we will be talking to Gerald Gems, the author of a new book called Sport and the Shaping of Civic Identity in Chicago. Jerry, how are you this morning? Welcome to the show.
Well, good morning. Thank you for inviting me.
Good. Jerry, I really, really enjoyed the book. I think that there's a lot of very good information here about how different constituencies in the city of Chicago have utilized sport to their benefit or to claim space in the city. We're going to talk a little bit about those various groups as we go forward. Before we get started, please tell us a little bit about yourself and how you got interested in this particular topic.
Well, I am a native of Chicago, and much of my personal and professional life has revolved around the city. And so that has been a particular interest of mine. As you know, the University of Arkansas Press has a series on sport and urban studies, but they have no book, surprisingly, about Chicago. And so I thought it was time for somebody to put that story out there. Personally, just in terms of my own credentials, I was a professor at North Central College in Naperville, Illinois, a suburb of Chicago, for many years. And much of my personal and professional life has revolved around the city. But I've been the past president of the North American Society for Sport History, vice president of the International Society for the History of Physical Education and Sport, a Fulbright scholar, and this is, I think, about my 20th book. And now I am retired as professor emeritus and have more time to involve myself in writing books and continuing my research.
Well, let me ask you this and build on the point that you brought up in regards to the University of Arkansas series. I'm familiar with the series. I'm familiar with some of the cities that they have, the books that have been published on specific cities. Why do you think Chicago was overlooked?
I think possibly because there is quite a bit of information out there about Chicago. There's been a number of books about Chicago. There's been even more journal articles about Chicago. It's almost constantly in the media, but I don't know why they made that particular decision.
Okay. Well, then, Jerry, let's just start going through the various chapters of the book, and I just want to ask you a couple of questions about each section. In chapters 1 through 3, you provide a bit of the background of the city of Chicago and what makes it unique. What is unique about sport in the city of Chicago as compared to, say, New York City or Los Angeles or any other major metropolitan area?
Well, I think, first of all, its geographic location has a lot to do with the role of sport in the city. It's, I mean, since the 19th century, it's been the economic center of Midwest. It's been a transportation center. It was and still is, I think, the railroad center of the United States. Its airport, O'Hare Airport, has for a long time been the most used airport in the States. It's also, in terms of sport, it's also always been a center of sport. Both the National and the American Leagues in baseball were founded here. The Negro National League was founded in Chicago sometime later. It has been a leader in the parks and playgrounds movement that assimilated immigrants, as well as civic beaches. It has a number of iconic stadiums. And so it's been a locus for sport throughout most of its urban history.
Okay. You know, one of the things that I research is the role, obviously, of race or ethnic groups in sports. And you do that, I think, very well in Chapter 4. What role does race play in shaping sport of Chicago, the sport in Chicago? And specifically, I want you to talk about how African-Americans use sport to claim space and to claim really citizenship in the city of Chicago, especially after the Great Migration.
Yeah, the Great Migration obviously had a lot to do with it. But even before the typical dates for the migration around the World War I era, there were black groups traveling from the South to Chicago. And even by even before 1900, black baseball teams were playing interracial matches here. And in fact, Rube Foster, who then founds the Negro National League in Chicago, is one of those itinerant baseball players who comes from Texas to the city and begins playing with the black teams, who are playing against white teams in interracial matches, which would have been certainly not even permitted in the South and unusual in other places. About the time of the Great, actually before the Great Migration, Jack Johnson, the great black heavyweight champion, comes to Chicago and lives here. And as you know, his defeat of Jim Jeffries creates all kinds of issues with race relations in the United States and really challenges that, the white domination of the society. And as I said, Rube Foster then creates the Negro National League in Chicago when blacks could not play in the white major leagues. You had Fritz Pollard, who was the first black to play quarterback and to coach in the National Football League in the 1920s already as a Chicagoan. The Harlem Globetrotters, despite the name, were actually founded here in Chicago. And Chicago is a very segregated city, even today, it still is. But sport was one way in which the different groups could interact. They played interracial games, and it was a way for blacks to really challenge these stereotypes about them. And they did so successfully.
Now that you said that they did that successfully, can you give us maybe one or two examples of, from your research of African-Americans utilizing sport to successfully challenge certain notions about in themselves as individuals and as a community?
Yeah, the black baseball teams would often beat the white baseball teams. In terms of the Olympics, which is obviously an international sport, Chicago produced some of the first black Olympians, Sal Butler in long jump, Ralph Metcalf in, was a sprinter, Tidy Pickett was the first black female athlete on the Olympic team. And this all enabled blacks to challenge these notions of black ability or these false notions of white male supremacy, things like this in a very public manner, to break down these stereotypes about the blacks and then later other ethnic groups as well.
Okay. And now that you mentioned other ethnic groups, in Chapter 5, you talk about the role that ethnicity plays in shaping sport in Chicago. Can you talk specifically about two or three of the major ethnic groups and how they utilize sport in a way noted in a way similar to African Americans.
Yeah, in fact, Chicago has been named the most diverse of American cities because of all of its ethnic groups. And in fact, there were, as I said, a number of them. Among the Irish, we were among the first. Charles Comiskey was Irish, the founder of the White Sox team and one of the founders of the American League in baseball. The first great black celebrity superstar in the 1880s was a guy named Mike King Kelly, an Irishman. Mm-hmm. Many stories about him we don't have time to go into.
Yeah.
But the Germans were also an early group that migrated here, were very important in the labor movement, but also in the founding of bowling, the American Bowling Congress, as well as gymnastics, as were the Poles and the Czechs. The Scandinavians brought skiing and skating to the U.S., and the Italians were very prominent in boxing and baseball. In fact, one who's still very prominent, Jerry Colangelo, came from Chicago area, now owns, I think, four major sports franchises.
Mm-hmm.
The Jewish people were very prominent also in boxing. Abe Saperstein becomes the owner of the Globetrotters team. And more currently, a large Hispanic population. And of course, they have their superstars as well. Two that would be well known to probably most readers would be Minnie Minoso,
right.
Great for the White Sox, great Cuban player. And for the Cubs, Sammy Sosa, great Dominican home run hitter. So almost every group can relate to sport in Chicago and had their own heroes that they could idolize and also help to assimilate these groups into the larger social and public network.
And you know, that's a key point I think that you're bringing up, the ability of these ethnic groups to be able to assimilate into the broader society. Again, like you did with African Americans, can you maybe give us one or two examples off the top of your head concerning how a specific group, you know, when you mentioned Minnie Minoso, you mentioned Sammy Sosa. Obviously, when Sammy Sosa was at his height with the Cubs, everyone was on board with Sammy Sosa. How did the city perceive him and his Dominican background? Were there any changes that took place as a result of the way that Sammy's career ended, in the majors?
Yeah, I think, you know, it's in that respect, it's similar to the Jackie Robinson story, you know, in terms of being able to break down barriers, having various different ethnic or racial groups feeling a bigger part of the American polity. And Sosa was a hero on the level, at least the Chicagoans, on the level of Michael Jordan. I mean, he was that big in the city. With the doubts about his performance relative to, you know, PEDs and things like that, kind of tarnished that image, which never did with Jordan. But he certainly among the Dominican population and Hispanic population, as well as, you know, most other Chicago Cubs fans, he's still considered, as people do tend to look past some of these other things that might tarnish their legend and still hold them up as someone who broke barriers.
Okay. Well, okay, so we've talked a little bit about race. We've talked a little bit about ethnicity. Let's talk a little bit about class. In chapter 6, you know, it's the same type of question. How did the different classes utilize sport in Chicago? How did they use this endeavor to shape their identity? What claims did the various groups, the various class groups, make through their use of sport?
Well, social class has always been a major factor in Chicago. It's a working class town. It always has been. It revels in that identity. I think you saw the sport, the allowance of sport to provide or basically reinforce some of those class divisions. Early on in the 19th century, you had the wealthy with their yacht clubs and their segregated city or country clubs out in the suburbs, with the middle class trying to imitate the upper class with their tennis clubs, which were mostly in the city. Mm-hmm. But then you had the working class who didn't have designated spaces that they could call their own other than the parks and the playgrounds, which they did. Sometimes working class gangs took over the parks. And for the working class, physical prowess is particularly important. And so they took to particular sports such as boxing, and they could display their toughness publicly in the Golden Gloves boxing matches, the Catholic Youth Organization boxing matches. Mm-hmm. The settlement houses were developed in Chicago and spread around the country around the turn of the last century, specifically for the working classes. They provided teams for them. The industrial team started in Chicago. The George Pullman Railroad Manufacturing Company built a company town outside the city and used sport as a means to keep his workers occupied in their leisure time. Bars weren't allowed in the town, so that he would have reliable workers and productive workers. And this idea spread throughout the entire country. So they had ample opportunity to play on the industrial teams. And in fact, it was a great opportunity for workers because they spent at least half their day, maybe most of their day, practicing on the company team. In fact, teams like the Chicago Bears started as industrial teams, just after World War I. The other sport, particularly that the working class adopted as their own, was softball. Softball was founded in Chicago in 1887. It becomes really taken over by working class clubs and working class teams who still play a particular version of the sport with a 16-inch ball and no gloves. Okay, anybody that plays with a glove is considered less than masculine, and women play as well. So it's still considered a very kind of rough, tough working class sport that's played throughout the city, even today. In fact, some years ago, it had its own newspaper. It was covered in the media. Huge numbers of teams. I think that's covered somewhat in the book.
Let me ask you this: another working class sport, and this is a book that was part of this series. It's The Early Years of Chicago Soccer by Gabe Logan. What can you tell us about working class teams and soccer in Chicago?
Yeah, Gabe has done an excellent job and really some groundbreaking work there in terms of soccer, which isn't as much followed in the U.S. as it is elsewhere in the world. But it was a number of working class teams, again, who were able to adapt and bring their sports from Europe over here, incorporate them in the American system. A lot of the early teams were Irish teams, but as other ethnic groups came to the city, they formed their own teams. And before the World War I era, they already had an international league that they participated in. So again, it was a way for different groups to maintain their own cultures, but also to assimilate them to some degree in the American system through sports. And the whole idea of competition as the basis for the capitalist system, whether they knew it or not, they were learning certain of the American value systems just by participation in the league in these competitive events.
Let me ask you about something a little bit more current then, if I may. What is the presence? I mean, given that in Chicago, when you're talking about Latinos, which is my area of research, when you're talking about Latinos, primarily you're speaking about Mexicans, Mexican Americans, Salvadoreños, Guatemaltecos. Are there any type of soccer leagues that are predominantly Latino in Chicago at the current time?
Yeah, in fact, there's actually two large Latino groups. Puerto Ricans were actually the larger group that settled in Chicago, and both are largely concentrated in two separate Hispanic neighborhoods still in the city. As I said, it's still quite a segregated city. But yes, they do have their soccer leagues. The Chicago suburbs do as well. Aurora, which is west of Chicago, has a large group of Mexican soccer players. Some play in leagues. Others just play, you know, in the park districts. But some are organized leagues for youth groups, schools, and adult teams as well. So it's pretty widespread throughout the Chicago area at this point.
Okay.
The other sport that the Latinos are very much engaged in is boxing as well. There are a number of boxing clubs. The Chicago, well, right now because of the virus, they're called off. I was supposed to go to the Golden Gloves matches tonight, but many of the fighters in the boxing matches are Latinos as well.
Okay.
Men and women, both.
Oh, okay. All right. Speaking of women, in Chapter 7, you move on and you talk about the role of women in sports. So how were women initially limited in their ability to participate in sport in Chicago? And how have they challenged these notions in over the years?
Well, actually, women were not very limited in Chicago as an exception to many other places around the U.S. Because, as you know, university professors and other women and men as well were trying to and necessarily terminate, but transform women's sports into playing in a less masculine fashion, concerned about their physical health, reproductive abilities, and the mental aspects of competitiveness that men exhibited. And so they tried to create these play days for women. Well, in Chicago, that didn't go over so well, whereas the schools adhered to it. Women had plenty of opportunities to participate in sport in the park district teams, in on the industrial teams, in the YWCAs, in the Catholic Youth Organization, in the private clubs, who would take working class women in their club if they had outstanding ability. The All-American Girls Professional Baseball League was founded in Chicago. Chicago provided many of the early women's sports stars. Cecil Richards was claimed world boxing champion by the 1890s already. You had Margaret Abbott, who was a Chicagoan, who won first gold medal in golf in the 1900 Paris Olympics. Chicagoans were among the earliest Olympians, and they among the earliest Olympic teams. Chicagoans provided many of the members of those teams on the track teams, on the gymnastic teams, and a number of other cases. They also had national industrial basketball champions, things like that. So Chicago was always a hotbed for women's sport, in contrast to much of the other, many of the other parts of the country. So again, just like the ethnic groups, sport enabled women to challenge these stereotypical notions of them as the weaker sex, ways to challenge all these notions, and it carries over into the workforce then with, you know, later on we have, you know, the whole feminist movement and Billie Jean King and people like this, but it allows women to challenge, just like the ethnic groups, these negative notions about their physical abilities.
Okay. All right. So we the next particular area that you cover then now shifts over to religious groups. And, you know, you've mentioned the Catholic, the CYA on a couple of occasions. How did the various religious groups, particularly the Catholics, utilize sports to claim space in Chicago? And I know you did a wonderful article a few years ago on Catholic high schools playing football in Chicago and sort of the significance of that. Why don't you sort of talk about what you discuss in the chapter and maybe bring in a little bit of what you did in that article?
Okay. Chicago has been known as the most Catholic city in the country. That's probably still true. Many of these ethnic groups that we just mentioned very briefly were Catholics. Some of the Germans, certainly the Irish, the Italians, the Poles, some of the Czechs, and Hispanics all, you know, largely follow the Catholic religion. So Catholicism has been a large part of Chicago since the mid-19th century. And so the Catholics had their own separate athletic leagues, as did the public schools, since shortly after the turn of the 20th century. And in 1927, the Catholic League decided to challenge the public league champions to a city championship in football, right? This game comes off. It's eventually termed the Prep Bowl, kind of like the Super Bowl of professional football as far as the Chicago's are concerned. And this was an annual game that kept going on and on and on until I think about 1974. But actually, it's still played today, but it's no longer played between the two best teams because the Catholic schools were accepted into the state association in the early 1970s and now play for the state championship. The city championship isn't considered as big anymore, and so they usually their runner-up teams still playing that game, but it's not as big. But it was so huge at this time in 1937. The game is always played in Soldier Field, the biggest stadium in the city. More than 120,000 people attended the high school game, and they often had large crowds, not quite that big, but 90,000, over 100,000, 110,000. But that's more people than ever even seen the Super Bowl.
I was going to say that you realize that even when you're talking to someone who lives in Texas. When you mention 120,000 people going to a high school football game, even that will impress even someone in the state of Texas.
You guys got some big high school stadiums as well.
Absolutely. But I mean, I have heard of crowds in the 40s or 50,000 here in the state at various times, but I'd never heard of a high school football crowd hitting six figures.
Yeah, that's more than I've ever seen a professional game and even seen a Super Bowl. So that'll give you some idea of the interest in the game. A lot of the players on the public league teams were Catholics themselves. In fact, in this biggest game in 1937, I mean, the Catholics brought out their star quarterback with dislocated shoulder and strapped him up and had him play anyway. It was so important. And the top player on the other team, on the public league team, was a Catholic himself, led the nation in scoring that year with, I think, over 200 points or something like that. It was ridiculous. Mm-hmm. But, this was played out annually, and it meant much more than football to them. It was about, who even though there was a Catholic mayor, he had to split his time and sit half the game on one side of the stands and half the game on the other side. And eventually it brought the two teams together. What they eventually did in the 1930s is, after the game was over, to show, in a sense, no hard feelings, they joined the stars from both teams and created an all-star team that then would travel to Arizona and Los Angeles, I believe, to play some of the schools out there. And so, again, it was this merging of different religious groups into an American whole as one American team rather than the public's role is considered Protestants, even though, as I said, many of the public school students were Catholics. I mean, I can relate to this personally. We went to Catholic school, but the tuition was only $2 a month, but we couldn't even pay that, so my mother became the cook for the school. But many of these kids who couldn't afford to go to a parochial school went to the Catholic school, even though they're Catholic. So oftentimes it was Catholics playing against other Catholics, but the designation was if you went to public, you were less than a real Catholic. You were, somebody else considered a Protestant.
Yeah, yeah. And believe me, that point that you've just brought up brings back a lot of memories for me growing up in Miami, in the Cuban American section of the city in the 1960s. If you sent your kids to public school, then you were somehow not as Catholic as you were supposed to be. So that's a very interesting point.
Yeah, I think there were a couple of other ways in which the Catholics made a in some ways changed sport in DePaul University, which had been a basketball power for many years and is currently the largest Catholic university in the country in terms of student enrollment. But in the 1940s, DePaul had a basketball player named George Mikan, who was, I think, about 6'10", one of the very first really big men who transformed the game. They had to come up with rules about goaltending and dunking and things like that. and then he goes on to revolutionize the pros, playing for the Minneapolis Lakers, which they were at the time, and other big men would then follow, you know, which changed the nature of the game, such as Bill Russell and Will Chamberlain, people like that. Another Catholic school, Loyola University, in 1963, won the NCAA championship in remarkable fashion, I think in an overtime game with Cincinnati, by playing four black players, which was a first at the time. There had been three players in the team, four, and then eventually, as you would know, Texas Western actually fields an entirely black team to win the championship. But this was a revolutionary change, a step-by-step change in the basketball world, and in terms of acceptance of different racial or ethnic groups within the society. And sport, you know, sport provides that opportunity on a very public display for the whole country and whole world to see, actually.
Yeah. And we've sort of touched on it in our discussion a little bit about the role of high school sports. And one of the questions, or one of the areas that I'm always very interested in, because I do research a lot about high school sports, is, you know, high school sports are tremendously important. I mean, you know, you can't live anywhere in the state of Texas and not recognize that. Even in the larger metropolitan areas, especially high school football is huge here. How does high school sports fit into the overall relationship of various groups in the city of Chicago? You know, you have some schools that maybe are predominantly of this particular ethnic group versus playing schools from another different ethnic group or another racial group. How does high school sports play into this story?
Yeah, high school sports has a lot to do with it. It may be not as important as things are in Texas, but certainly early on, the students of the high schools actually formed their own athletic conferences by the late 1880s, 1890s already. And adults tried to take control of that process and administer it. By 1895, the University of Illinois runs a track meet and tries to incorporate the students into a state association, which wasn't entirely successful. But similar to the challenge matches between the Catholics and the public schools, in Chicago has had the nickname of the Second City. I mean, and the Windy City, and the way those came about was, Chicago was growing at such a fast rate that it fully expected to surpass New York, which is why it got the 1893 World's Fair. And the New Yorkers gave the Chicagoans the nickname of the Windy City, not because of the climate, but because they were always bragging about how great Chicago was. And so in 1902, the New Yorkers challenged Chicago to a high school football match, which would be considered the national championship. So the New Yorkers come to Chicago. They play at the University of Chicago Field. The Chicagoans have a great team. Hyde Park High School has got Walter Eckersall, who's still considered one of the greatest college quarterbacks ever, and a black athlete named Sam Ransom, who's actually the star of the team. Chicago wins 105-0, and it played a revolutionary style of game, whereas the New Yorkers would play the old style of smash-mouth football, pile-ups at the line. The Chicagoans were running reverses, running the ends with a lot of speed. I think Ransom scores like 7 touchdowns or something. And so the New Yorkers are so upset, they actually hire one of the Chicago coaches to come and coach their team next year. And then the Chicagoans go to New York the following year in 1903, right? Two different teams. They have to call the game off after about 3 quarters because of darkness, and the Chicagoans were winning at that time 75-0. So 2 years in a row, Chicago decimates New York in this supposedly national football championship, which allows the Chicagoans again to claim that they are better than New York. They're not the second city. They're playing a whole new brand of football, which will then turn into the forward pass and everything a few years later. The other thing about the high school was that Amos Alonzo Stagg, very famous coach at the University of Chicago, starts running national invitational tournaments for both basketball and track. He would not invite Catholic schools, and so Loyola University starts its own national basketball tournament for Chicago, for Catholic schools around the country. These are, you know, they invite state champions from the different states to come and play in this tournament. This went on for a number of years until the Athletic Association steps in, because obviously what they were doing was getting a head start on everybody else in terms of getting to see and assess the top high school athletes in the entire country, who they would then try to recruit to their particular schools for their teams. And so this was eventually stopped, but it was for, you know, 20 years or so a tremendous opportunity for both the University of Chicago and Loyola to maintain prowess in their athletic teams. And it's really part of the early process of recruiting that we see so much about today, always in the news and scandals at the, you know, payoffs to students and other types of things. This was going on way back then already. But these high school teams are important also because what it does is, before and still today, as I said, a lot of the Chicago neighborhoods are still ethnically based neighborhoods. And years ago, you know, somebody from another group just walked through, they might get beat up just for being in the wrong place. But by the turn of the century and thereafter, you had the states all requiring mandatory education, in at least at the age of 16. And so all these different ethnic groups then started attending the high schools, and the high school teams then became not just any one specific ethnic group, although it might be if it was simply located within a purely ethnic neighborhood. But when they brought in students from different ethnic groups, the best players from each ethnic group might be on the team. Again, it presented an image and eventually a breakdown of these ethnic stereotypes into a larger identity as an American team, not just a Polish team or you know, a German team, an Irish team, or whatever it might be.
And you know, what role, let me just sort of back up just a little bit then, what role does class, you know, in my research here in Texas, you know, for example, in El Paso, in the early 1920s, when you're starting to play high school football, you'll have a school that's called El Paso Bowie. It's 99.9% Mexican, and then they'll play El Paso Austin, which is 99% white, and the football rivalry becomes a way for that ethnic rivalry to play itself out. Are there any examples like that in the city of Chicago? Maybe not so much with ethnic groups, but like maybe different. You know, this school is in the wealthy part of town versus the school's in the poor side of town. And how does that play out?
Yeah, you see it in both racial and ethnic lines. Some of the ethnic neighborhoods, especially in Hispanic neighborhoods, where all the soccer teams are prominent and often better than perhaps the white teams from you know, other areas, you still see that process playing out. But you also see it in racial groups as well, especially, as I said, Chicago is still a very segregated city, especially in terms of African Americans living in particular areas in the South Side and the West Side, and those schools are entirely African American. And so all the kids in that team would be black players. And again, it's a way for them to, similar to 100 years ago, to break down stereotypes. Hopefully they're not as stringent as they had been. But it's a way for them to get publicity they wouldn't get normally because they are covered in the media, the newspapers, and on the television, throughout the season, especially in basketball as well. And so they're getting a lot of media coverage that they wouldn't ordinarily get. And so it does help to break down those barriers and provide, a more positive image of different groups.
Now, you said something very interesting just now. You brought up the point of, you know, that things in certain ways are as they were 100 years ago. You've reiterated that the city of Chicago is still very, very segregated, but Have things moved in a positive direction? Are they continuing to move in a positive direction if they have?
I think incrementally. I think sports is a great social leveler in that respect. But it also creates other kinds of issues, I think. You know, for example, you've got, you know, I know of situations where I've had one in my own class, but, you know, poor kids who look to sport, professional sport, as their way to a better life, to, you know, greater socioeconomic status. But it's not a realistic for most people. You know, very, very small percentage of people are going to make it to professional levels, and those careers are quite short. But kids who believe that they're going to do it, I mean, there's, you know, I know a story of a kid who's eighth kid on the bench, you know, he's barely playing, but he still believes he's going to make it in the NBA. That coach just doesn't like me. Sooner or later, somebody's going to see how good I am. In my own class, I had a situation with a kid, you know, who were Division III school. You know, he wasn't even starting in a Division III school. So he transfers to USC, thinking he's going to get a better shot at the NFL. I mean, that's just not reality. But, you know, kids have these dreams, but they're not very realistic. And so in some ways it's counterproductive. In other ways, it does provide these kids with not only a better sense of identity, and especially in the inner city here in Chicago, we have huge problems with gangs and shootings. You know, it keeps them out of trouble. It gives them a more positive approach to life, and hopefully some sense of security. Although neighborhoods are pretty rough in some places.
Okay. Well, Jerry, we've covered a wide swath of sport in Chicago, but up till now, we haven't talked about really very much about professional sports. And I want to just shift gears to that for this last part of our discussion. As far as pro teams are concerned, Cubs fans, for example, are perceived as being, quote, different than those of other Major League Baseball teams. How are they different, if they are? And how do you think that maybe ties in with the identity of Chicago? The Cubs fans being Chicagoans, how does that sort of flesh out this story that you've been telling in this book?
Well, I think, I don't know that, you know, from my perspective, that Cubs fans are much different from other fans, but perhaps to others around the country, they may be. I think they very early on got it was an image of Cub fans as being very rowdy, which at that time was true. I think I tell some stories in the book about how a wealthy man would not let her daughter marry the guy who was the Cubs center fielder at the time because of the nature of their lifestyle. And a lot of that was brought about by, as I said, mentioned earlier, King Kelly, who was a pretty rowdy guy, and there's some really interesting stories about him in some of them which I put in the book. But he was the first great superstar in baseball, but a heavy drinker as well. There were stories about Cubs fans early on, about around the turn of the 20th century, who would bring their guns to the ballpark, and they would intimidate opposing pitchers by shooting it off as they started to pitch. I mean, these guys would be spooked, you know. I guess relative to Cubs fans, then you get to the 1970s where we had the group known as the Bleacher Bums, you know, young working class guys in hard hats who would play pranks and joke with the opposing players and maybe drop beer on them if they tried to catch a fly ball near the wall or something like that. But those all added to kind of this idea of the rowdy Cub fans. But that was generational, I think. The Bleacher Bums today are now older, middle-class people who they can't really reserve their seats, but they're in de facto reserved because each person knows who sits where, and they're friends until they die. They attend almost every game. But the Wrigley, the whole Wrigley area, which had been a working class area, has now been gentrified. And now it's really a hangout for millennials and younger people. In fact, now they call Wrigley the world's largest outdoor bar. And people go there basically to party, to have a good time, regardless of the score of the game, which is very different from Sox fans on the south side. The Sox fans basically take an oath when they've been asked, you know, who's your favorite team? They'll always say the Sox and whoever is playing the Cubs. So the Sox fans still have that rowdy image. I think probably well, certainly it goes all the way back to the Black Sox and gambling, which actually, and the whole next decade was the Al Capone decades, which has still presented Chicago with a very negative image that it still carries. But the Sox fans were really known for, in 1979, what they called Disco Demolition. A local DJ had encouraged Sox fans to come to the ballpark, all rock and roll fans or heavy metal fans or whatever, to bring hated disco records to the ballpark. It was a doubleheader. I think it was with Detroit Tigers, if I remember correctly. But during intermission between the games, they stacked the records up around second base and they were going to blow them up. Well, it turned into a huge riot. It damaged the field. The young fans ran all over the field, rioted to some extent. And the Sox actually had to forfeit the second game and couldn't play it. But that's the image of Chicago fans. Although I said, culture changes, generations change. Wrigley, the whole neighborhood has been very much gentrified, and so it's got a different image today, in the sense of more of a partying atmosphere than maybe a hostile atmosphere. I certainly wouldn't equate it with, say, Philadelphia fans, especially Philadelphia football fans, who I would say are much.
Let me ask you this: is there a certain sense of difference for Bears fans, Bulls fans, Blackhawk fans? Are they perceived as being different from the fans of their teams in the various sports? Or is this mostly a Cubs and maybe White Sox thing?
I think it's mostly a baseball thing. There's clear divisions between the Cubs and Sox fans. But the Bear fans, and they're similar to any other football fans. They dress up in their costumes. They go to the game. You know, they cheer and they yell and they drink a lot of beer. And the Bulls fans still are basking in the Jordan mania. You know, they don't have much to cheer about at this point. You know, the team's pretty bad. But you know, the fact that Michael Jordan played here, they have, you know, a statue of him outside the stadium, which only a few years ago was still the most visited tourist site in the city. And as far as the NHL goes, they also have their stars and cast in, you know, statues outside the same location. You know, but they didn't have much to cheer about either. The 1960s was big when they had Bobby Hull, Stan Mikita, and some Stanley Cup wins, and more recently with some of their younger stars. But it's a seasonal thing. You know, they when they got something to cheer about, they can get rowdy, but not on the level of the early Cubs fans. But right now, those teams are not performing very well, and so the Cubs, especially with the World Series win finally after more than a century, have a huge following in the city.
Well, you know what, Jerry, I do have to tell you, and this probably is gonna hurt you a little bit hearing this from me, but you know, probably one of the greatest moments in my life was when the Florida Marlins, my hometown team, defeated the Cubs in that National League Championship Series, and then went on to defeat the Evil Empire in the 2003 World Series. So from a distance, I do also owe a lot, I think, to the Cubs.
Yeah, I think I covered that a little bit in the book with the guy who actually caught the ball or interfered with the ball, actually, he got death threats. He actually had to leave the city. He's, you know, it was not until Cubs won the World Series that the team itself formally invited him back to be a part of the celebration, because he's been, you know, not only ostracized and chased out of the city, but people were threatening to kill the poor guy. But that's how serious they take their baseball.
Well, Jerry, is there, I mean, we've covered a lot of ground here. Is there any topic that you cover in the book that we haven't discussed that you wanted to point out or mention?
Well, maybe. We did cover a lot of ground in obviously much more detail in the book. But some of the things that I did mention there were some of the iconic stadiums. We talked about Wrigley Field. I think it's still the second oldest baseball stadium in the National League or in Major League Baseball, actually. But it has quite an interesting history behind it. The Chicago Stadium was another one that's no longer there. It's been replaced by the United Center, which is now the home to the both the Bulls and the Blackhawks. But the Chicago Stadium was really a major center of boxing matches, and then housed the original Chicago Blackhawks ice hockey team in for many years. But some of the most iconic boxing matches in the history of that sport took place in that edifice. And Soldier Field itself, as I said, has been around since mid-1920s. It has housed not only, tremendous football games, but boxing matches as well. Some of the top boxing matches took place there, as well as all kinds of things, rodeos, ski jumping, auto races. The 1959, I believe it was, Pan American Games all took place at Soldier Field. So it has quite a history of its own. So the stadiums, I think, are of particular significance in Chicago, as well as some of the great teams and, other particular factors in the rise of sport throughout the country.
Well, Jerry, we've taken up a lot of your time. So we're at over 50 minutes by this stage of the game. I love the book. It is a wonderful, wonderful read, as are all of your works. I think this is a project. This is a book that people really need to look at, because it's not just the flavor of the city, but how sport is bigger than just simply what the action that takes place on the field.
Yeah, I would certainly agree. I thank you for your compliments. But I think Chicago is this really diverse city where you can see sport as a primary factor in the building of a community, in providing a unity, and also a collective identity as something beyond just an ethnic, a racial, a religious group, is something bigger than that.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much for your time. I just strongly suggest that everyone who listens to this podcast go out and pick up a copy of Sport and the Shaping of Sport Identity in Chicago. It's a wonderful, wonderful read. Thank you very much, Jerry.
Thank you, Jorge.